In 1957, standing in a newly independent Ghana, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. declared, "The forces of the universe are on the side of justice." He called it the birth of a new nation and a signal to the world that freedom is indivisible. Nearly 70 years later, that global call still echoes. This year marks the 20th anniversary of WNYC's annual tribute to Dr. King, presented in partnership with the Apollo and in collaboration with March On. MLK, the Pan-Africanist, explores Dr. King's journey to Ghana and how that moment shaped his vision of global liberation, linking the fight against colonialism abroad to the struggle for civil rights at home. From Accra to Atlanta, from past to present, from vision to action. Join us for MLK, the Pan-Africanist, a conversation, reflection, and a call to conscience.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. 1,500 active-duty U.S. military troops are on standby to possibly deploy to Minneapolis. They're based in Alaska and trained to operate in cold weather. It's around 7 below in Minneapolis this morning. Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters reports the Justice Department says it won't investigate the killing of Renee Macklin Good by a federal immigration officer in Minneapolis.
Assistant Attorney General Todd Blanche said on Fox News Sunday that the Justice Department investigates when it's appropriate to do so, but that's not the case here, he said, when an ICE agent fatally shot Macklin Good on January 7th. The DOJ blocked Minnesota from accessing evidence and witnesses, so the state has their own investigation going on.
DOJ has opened an investigation into Governor Tim Walz and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey. President Trump is threatening to impose tariffs on goods imported from several NATO allies that sent small numbers of troops to Greenland. Trump continues to say the U.S. needs to acquire the territory of Denmark in the interest of national security. A spokesperson for the World Economic Forum, happening in Switzerland this week, says Danish officials will not attend. President Trump is expected there. Terry Schultz reports Denmark's top diplomat is visiting the country's closest allies.
Danish Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen will visit the UK and Sweden as his government continues to build support in the face of President Trump's warnings that he still intends to acquire Greenland. This is not just an issue between Denmark and the U.S., Rasmussen told journalists as he departed, adding, "This is a question of world order and the future of the NATO alliance." Denmark and the seven NATO allies that participated in last week's mission to Greenland released a statement explaining the exercise was in the transatlantic interest. Trump called the temporary deployment a very dangerous game. It poses no threat to anyone, they countered, underscoring they're still interested in dialogue with Washington. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz.
The U.S. Supreme Court could decide this week whether a broad swath of President Trump's tariffs are legal. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben has more.
The case focuses on the country-by-country tariffs Trump announced last year, saying they were retaliation against what he sees as other countries' unfair trade practices. The government's opponents in the case argue that Trump exceeded the economic powers Congress granted to him under IEEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. The case clearly is top of mind for Trump, and he brings it up routinely in speeches and when talking to reporters. Several justices, including conservatives, expressed skepticism at the government's arguments in the case. If the court rules against Trump, it's possible his administration would use other laws to try to replace the overturned tariffs.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A star of the Avatar movie franchise is now the highest-grossing actor of all time. As NPR's Netta Ulibi reports, Zoe Saldana's movies have collectively grossed more than $15 billion.
Zoe Saldana has starred in the top three highest-grossing movies of all time: the first Avatar movie, the second Avatar movie, and Avengers Endgame. Plus, she's shown up in other lucrative franchises, Guardians of the Galaxy and Star Trek. But it was the box office receipts for Avatar, Fire and Ash that pushed her ahead of Scarlett Johansson and Samuel L. Jackson as the world's highest-grossing star.
I'm in this place where I have nothing.
In the Avatar movies, Saldana plays a blue-skinned member of a forest tribe on a faraway planet.
This is the Great Mother's plan.
Saldana is also the first actress who has starred in four movies that each pulled in more than $2 billion globally. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
Venus Williams made history this weekend as the oldest woman to compete in an Australian Open singles main draw. She is 45. Williams was 17 when she first competed in the tournament. This weekend, she led 4-0 in the third set before losing. Williams will compete in doubles. Portugal's presidential election will go to a runoff. Antonio José Seguro, the former head of the country's Socialist Party, will face far-right leader André Ventura, who placed second. Portugal's president is a largely ceremonial role, but does have key powers. The runoff is on February 8th. I'm Kristen Wright, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is MLK, the Pan-Africanist, a special from WNYC. I'm Terrence McKnight. Coming up in this hour, you'll hear from an annual celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. recorded live at the historic Apollo Theater. We will take you there now. Please welcome to the Apollo stages at the Victoria, NYC, now host Janae Pierre and WNYC Morning Edition host Michael Hill.
This is our 20th annual MLK celebration. We have political scientists, historians, authors, and activists, and we have big musical performances, and we have an appropriate MLK speech for this occasion.
Today's program is all about understanding Dr. King as a global citizen, someone deeply engaged in Pan-African thought and action.
From continental Africa to the African diaspora, today's program will weave a narrative from Ghana and Nigeria through the Caribbean and right back here to the United States.
Yep. We'll explore how the civil rights movement inspired anti-colonialism, how Black liberation theology and global liberation philosophy color Dr. King's perspectives relative to injustice.
Heavy topics with heavy hitters. Welcome to MLK 26, Dr. King, the Pan-Africanist. Enjoy the show. Let's get started.
Joining Michael Hill on the Victoria stage is the president of the National Urban League, Mark Morial, and the John L. Loeb Associate Professor on the Social Sciences at Harvard University, Dr. Brandon Terry.
President Morial, yeah, Professor
Good morning,
Terry.
Good afternoon, good day. Yes,
thank you very much for being here. It's an honor to welcome you here. This panel is largely shaped by the National Urban League's State of Emergency, Democracy, Civil Rights, and Progress Under Attack. The State of Black America report came out in July of 2025. We'll unpack the report and explore just how dire these two gentlemen believe things have become. Mark Morial, we start with you. Why declare a state of emergency?
Because there is a state of emergency. Let's just take democracy. One of the fundamental components of democracy is the right to vote. All the way back in 2013, the Supreme Court of the United States effectively gutted one of the most important provisions of the Voting Rights Act. And the Voting Rights Act of 65, which really made the promise of the 15th Amendment enabled African Americans and other people of color to participate meaningfully in the political process. Its cutback and the erosion that the Supreme Court occasioned led to just an avalanche of voter suppression legislation and laws all throughout the United States at more than 40 state legislatures. Number two, the rise of Trump and Trumpism, important to understand that there's Trump and Trumpism, has led to an assault on diversity, equity, and inclusion, but that is an assault on equal opportunity. It is an assault on the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It's an assault on the value proposition that everyone has a right to participate in the American dream. And so, these efforts are active, well-funded. They have political support to really erase and really marginalize the progress of the civil rights movement that began in 1954 with the Brown decision. So we must call it for what it is, and it is a state of emergency and a call to action and a call to resist and a call for people to stand up for what I think is everyone's birthright, and that is the right to participate fully and completely in the American dream.
Dr. Terry, in your latest publication, Shattered Dreams, Infinite Hope, you share the concept of tragic hope. Now, if someone doesn't know what an oxymoron is, tragic hope is certainly one of them.
Well, I think, first of all, thank you for having me. And I think that it's partly one of the many degenerations of our vocabulary that we now see that as only an oxymoron or a paradox. When you trace the history of thinking in tragic terms back to the Greeks, what they were trying to confront is the same thing we're trying to confront, is the deepest questions of pessimism, right? Is life worth living? Is there a hope for fairness and decency and justice or mercy toward the people who are suffering? How should we think about our strivings in a world where they may not come true, where we face extraordinary obstacles, as President Morial has brilliantly laid out? And so the question is, well, how can you hope in the face of despair, right? And our big challenge, so President Morial has laid out a lot of our political challenges, but we also have a spiritual challenge, which is, how do we get people galvanized in the face of the extraordinary struggle we have in front of us and not to give up? And for me, that's about being able to accept a certain number of things that I think tragedy lays out. One of them is that we are always going to face serious conflict. One of the mythologies that we've been telling ourselves about the civil rights movement is that everyone agreed. We convinced everyone. There was a kind of underlying consensus. That wasn't true. And the fact that Trumpism has found such favorable soil shows how deep the disagreements remained. We have to face the fact that our victories aren't guaranteed. We were telling ourselves a story of inevitable progress, progress that can never be defeated. The history of Reconstruction teaches us differently. We're living through a moment that's quite similar. We need to tell ourselves a history about taking responsibility in the face of these controversies and conflicts, because the number one thing to remember is that this could be even worse, right? As awful as it is, this could become worse. We could actually lose the spirit of democracy. And so it's incumbent upon us, even if we don't win everything, to win something and to prevent the greatest defeat imaginable.
Dr. Terry, King described America as having a congenital deformity of racism that festers and rots. I'm going to read that again. King described America as having a congenital deformity of racism that festers and rots. How does this notion inform how we see America?
Well, first of all, it should inform how we see Dr. King and the holiday we're celebrating. There's a reason that's not among the most quoted words of Dr. King, right? But it's one he deeply believed. And the history backs him up. We're about to head into the 100th celebration of what was once Negro History Week and now Black History Month. And it coincides with the 250th anniversary of the founding. And we are at a crossroads with popular historical understanding. One of the things that was striking about the so-called woke years is its intense focus on uncovering histories that had been lost. So one of the things that's really difficult to accept about the founding of this country is that many African Americans fought on the side of the British because Lord Dunmore promised them that they would be free if they fought. Our country still, the country that became the United States, has had slavery longer than we've had freedom, still, in the year 2026. The great economist at Princeton, Allura Duranikor, shows that at the end of slavery, there was a 60-to-1 wealth differential between whites and blacks. There is no known economic growth that could have closed that gap. There's no known rate of economic growth that could have closed that gap. We've had inherited deep racial stigma. Indeed, one of the first things that American citizens did together as a civic enterprise, while in New England people were doing town halls, and the South people were doing slave patrols. Part of how they forge what we do together as American citizens is to patrol for Black people who weren't where they're supposed to be. That is deeply rooted in our constitutional structure. When we talk about how there can be a minority control, not our minority, but a minority control over American politics, that's rooted in compromises that trace back to slavery. So if you want to unravel these things, and if you want to really raise the questions that the civil rights movement was raising about what would the fair value of our equal rights really look like? What would genuine empowerment for Black people really look like? It calls into question things that people treat as sacrosanct in American history. It calls into question constitutional settlements, municipal boundaries, economic order. Those are what King is trying to draw our attention to, while nevertheless saying the democratic spirit is real. And we can fight for it. We don't have to let the congenital deformity win.
The Honorable John Lewis implored us to get in good trouble, necessary trouble, and help redeem the soul of America. Mr. Mayor, for those compelled to join the fight for justice and democracy, what can be done?
By saying get in good trouble, what John Lewis is reminding us is that friction and tension and productive conflict is necessary to move the needle. He's reminding us that this is not always going to be kumbaya. It's not going to be a consensus, that everyone will not agree. And because everyone does not agree does not mean we should back off or fold our tent or not fight. His life is a reflection of that, from activist to politician who never, ever failed to take the House floor to raise his voice in moral outrage at what was happening in America at the time. And he was like Dr. King in that Dr. King had this unique ability, which I think we should never miss, of melding the teachings of the Constitution with the teachings of the Bible into a very coherent, understandable narrative.
How about a hand for our guest? Dr. Brandon Terry and President Mark Morial. Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment with more of MLK, the Pan-Africanist. Stay with us.
The fantasy writer George R.R. Martin suffered an epic case of writer's block while trying to finish Game of Thrones.
We're not talking about being stuck for a day or a week or a month. We're talking about a matter of many years. And he's expressed great puzzlement because he was so productive for so long.
Why we fall into ruts and how to break free, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. The forecast for our listening area today, cloudy skies with a few flurries or snow showers possible and a high near 24. Tonight, a few clouds and extremely cold with a low near 5. And tomorrow night, a mix of clouds and sun in the morning followed by cloudy skies later in the afternoon, few flurries or snow showers possible once again, and a high only up to 13, followed by tomorrow night, which will be even colder with a low near 0 degrees. This is Radio Catskill. local news, culture, and NPR.
You're listening to MLK, the Pan-Africanist, a special from WNYC, the Apollo Theater, and March On. Let's get back to the stage at the Apollo, where our hosts are celebrating the life and legacy of Martin Luther King Jr.
Please welcome back to the stage NYC Now host, Janae Pierre. She's joined by the Deputy Executive Director of African Communities Together, Diana Konoté.
All right, Diana, thank you so much for being here. I want to start our conversation exploring the connection between Dr. King's civil rights movement and immigration policy.
Sure. So, you know, around when we saw the Civil Rights Act pass, the Voting Rights Act pass, one of the things that also changed in this country was our immigration policy, with the passing of the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1965. So all of that was happening around the same time. Mm-hmm. And what that replaced was our previous immigration policy, which was based on national origin. Prior to the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1965, I'll call it the INA, in this country, our immigration policy was based on where someone was from, their country of origin. And the idea around that was that the government was trying to ensure that immigrants to this country were mainly from Northern Europe, and they wanted to keep out certain other folks, mainly from Eastern Europe, Southern Europe, Asians, Africans. And so that was kind of, you know, what it was from around the 1920s until 1965.
That's crazy. It sounds like 2026.
Yes, yes. And we see a lot of the policies that this administration is implementing really mirroring what was in place in the 20s. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of what we're fighting against.
Yeah, let's stay there for a second because we do have another 3 years of President Trump's evolving immigration policy. What do you see those next 3 years looking like? I know, hold on, you need some water?
I'm afraid. I mean, over just this year alone, next week makes it 1 year.
Yeah.
We have seen an attempt to end birthright citizenship. We've seen a suspension of our refugee resettlement program. The program has been suspended for everyone. The number has been decreased. The number of refugees we will resettle has been decreased from 125,000 to 7,500. All of those slots, most of those slots, are being reserved for white South Africans. We have seen an attempt to dismantle our asylum system. We've seen a suspension of the diversity visa program. We've seen the increase in enforcement internally, which has led to changes in policies that now allow ICE to essentially run amok. They are arresting people at courthouses, schools, churches, places that have been previously considered sensitive locations where they were not allowed to go. You know, people's due rights are being, people don't have due rights at this point.
I was about to say, what rights?
Yeah. You know, we've seen the number of immigration detention just explode. In the beginning of the Trump administration, I believe there were about close to 40,000 immigrants in detention. Now we are at around 70,000. Their goal is to reach, I believe the number I saw was 108,000. You know, they're going to get to a point where they have more folks in immigration detention than regular prisons. It's a really scary thing. And those are the things that have happened in the year.
Yeah.
So thinking about what the next 3 years would be, it's very scary.
Thank you so much. Give it up for our guests.
Mm.
Upon returning from Ghana, witnessing a new nation emerge, Dr. King was deeply moved. In April of 1957, Dr. King gave a speech entitled Birth of a New Nation, wherein he paralleled the defeat of colonialism by Africans on the African continent with the struggle for civil rights by African Americans in America. To interpolate Dr. King's speech, please welcome to the stage New York-based storyteller, griot, poet, and playwright, Kamau Nasakere, along with creative producer and arts professional, Emily Matos.
There is a great day ahead. The future is on its side. It's going now through the wilderness, but the promised land is ahead.
Now, I want to take just a few more minutes as I close to say three or four things that this reminds us of and things that this says to us.
Things that we must never forget.
As we ourselves find ourselves breaking loose from an evil Egypt, trying to move through the wilderness toward the promised land of cultural integration,
Ghana has something to say to us.
It says to us, first, that the oppressor never voluntarily gives freedom to the oppressed. You have to work for it.
And if Nkrumah and the people of the Gold Coast had not stood up persistently, revolting against the system, it would still be a colony of the British Empire. Freedom is never given to anybody.
For the oppressor has you in domination because he plans to keep you there. And he never voluntarily gives it up.
And that is where the strong resistance comes. Privileged classes never give up their privileges without strong resistance. So don't go out this morning with any illusions.
Don't go back into your homes and around Montgomery thinking that the Montgomery City Commission and that all of the forces in the leadership of the South will eventually work out this thing for Negroes.
It's going to work out. It's going to roll in on the wheels of inevitability. If we wait for it to work itself out, it will never be worked out. Freedom only comes through persistent revolt,
through persistent agitation,
through persistently rising up against the system of evil.
The bus protest is just the beginning.
Buses are integrated in Montgomery, but that is just the beginning.
And don't sit down and do nothing now because the buses are integrated.
Because if you stop now,
we will be in the dungeons of segregation and discrimination for another 100 years. And our children's children
will suffer all of the bondage that we have lived under for years. It never comes voluntarily.
We've got to keep on keeping on in order to gain freedom. It never comes like that.
It would be fortunate if the people in power had sense enough to go on and give up, but they don't do it like that.
It is not done voluntarily, but it is done through the pressure that comes about from people who are oppressed. If there had not been a Gandhi in India with all of his noble followers, India would have never been free.
If there had not been an Nkrumah and his followers in Ghana, Ghana would still be a British colony. If there had not been abolitionists in America, both Negro and white, we might still stand today in the dungeons of slavery.
And then, because there have been...
In every period.
There are always those people in every period of human history who don't mind getting their necks cut off.
Who don't mind being persecuted and discriminated and kicked out.
Because they know that freedom is never given out, but it comes through the persistent and
the
continual
agitation and revolt
on the part of those who are caught in the system. Ghana teaches us that.
It says to us another thing.
It reminds us of the fact that a nation
or a people
can break a loose from oppression without violence.
Please welcome back to the stage WNYC's Michael Hill. He's joined by the director of the Carter G. Woodson Institute for African American and African Studies at the University of Virginia, Dr. Robert Trent Benson.
We just heard an excerpt of Dr. King's Birth of a New Nation speech. Why is this your favorite King speech?
It's my favorite speech because this is the moment where King really contextualizes the U.S. Civil Rights Movement in global terms. He is understanding what W.B. Du Bois said in 1900 about the global color line, that there's a global color line that includes U.S. Jim Crow, European colonialism in Africa and the Caribbean and Asia. And coming off the Montgomery bus boycott victory, he understands that that work is not yet done. And that Birth of a New Nation speech represents his return from Ghana and his understanding that the U.S. Civil Rights Movement is part of a global effort to dismantle the global color line. And that includes ending European colonialism in Africa. And Ghana, for him, is the first major blow in that struggle.
Did he understand what was going on in Africa before he got there?
Absolutely. He had some understanding of what was happening. He knew that there was European colonialism in Africa. He knew that there were only two independent African countries at that time, Ethiopia and Liberia. And so he had that awareness, but he wanted to go to see for himself. He wanted to witness the independence celebrations in Ghana on March 6, 1957. And he really wanted to meet the new Ghanaian Prime Minister, Kwame Nkrumah, who was taking the Pan-African mantle from W.B. Du Bois at that time. Nkrumah had been born in 1909 in the British colony of the Gold Coast. He had spent 12 years in the United States studying. He graduated from Lincoln University, the University of Pennsylvania. And while Nkrumah was in the United States from 1933 to 1945, he became a follower of Marcus Garvey. And so Nkrumah, a deep Pan-Africanist, understood that European colonialism was connected to U.S. Jim Crow. And so Nkrumah invited King to come witness the independence celebrations. And King jumped at the opportunity. And it was not just King, of course. Coretta Scott King came as well. And they were supported by their congregation, the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, who raised $2,500 for them to go. Now, that's $2,500 in 1957 money.
Wow.
That's about $30,000 today.
Wow.
And so we have to honor not just the Kings, but their congregation, who also had this Pan-African sensibility, that it was important for their minister and his wife to witness those celebrations.
Well, now, before Nelson Mandela, South Africa had an anti-apartheid activist who not only was a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, but had a connection to Dr. King.
That's right. So this man was Albert Luthuli. He was Nelson Mandela before Nelson Mandela. If we imagine that Mandela that walked out of prison in 1990, Albert Luthuli won the Nobel Peace Prize, as you say, in 1961, and he won that Peace Prize for his efforts leading the African National Congress, the leading anti-apartheid organization in South Africa, in their struggle against apartheid. Now, Luthuli had actually visited the U.S. South in 1948. He had done a six-month tour, mostly speaking at historically black colleges and universities. But he also, in Atlanta, he stayed in the home of Martin Luther King Sr., just a few days after Junior had graduated from Morehouse. And so there's this connection between South Africa and African America as early as 1948, and between King and Luthuli. And so when King wins his Nobel Peace Prize in 1964, he name checks Albert Luthuli and says that if I was South African, I would have been a follower of Albert Luthuli and his program of Gandhian civil disobedience and nonviolence. And so King was a deep Pan-Africanist who was engaged with Kwame Nkrumah. He also visited Nigeria in 1960 for Nigerians' independence ceremonies. And the Nigerian president, Nnamdi Azikiwe, had also graduated from Lincoln University, had also gone to Howard University. And so this Pan-Africanism was going both ways. It was multi-directional. And so in that way, King was deeply invested in what was happening across the continent, Ghana, Nigeria, South Africa. The Birth of the New Nation speech speaks to this sense of African history, that our history started before the Atlantic slave trade. He speaks to the breadth of Africa. In this way, he's a Pan-Africanist. He has a deep appreciation for his African heritage. He has solidarity with African continental movements, and he sees the destiny of those in the diaspora tied up with the destiny of those on the continent. The struggle is indivisible for him. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, a part of King that we need to celebrate.
My guest has been Dr. Robert Trent Vincent. How about a hand for professor?
Coming up on MLK, the Pan-Africanist, we'll hear from Robert Vincent and Sandra Babu-Boateng discussing the global future, reconciliation, and restitution, recorded live at the Apollo Theater for our annual King Day celebration. Stay with us.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple, free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
Political polarization pushes people apart, but writer Chloe Valdery says we can close those divisions by allowing for one simple thing, the possibility that we can still be enchanted by the people around us.
When you remember this about your neighbor and you act accordingly, there will be less unnecessary suffering and less unnecessary pain in the world.
That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Kimberly Izar, host of Farming Country. Each week, we share the stories of farmers, growers, and neighbors who keep the Catskills and Upper Delaware River thriving. That's Farming Country, Saturday mornings at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to MLK, the Pan-Africanist, a special from WNYC, the Apollo Theater, and March On. Let's get back to the stage at the Apollo, where our hosts are celebrating the life and legacy of Martin Luther King Jr.
Please welcome back to the stage, Jhené Pierre. She's joined by the co-founder of new media company Panagenius and creator and host of The Breakdown, one of YouTube's fastest growing global Black affair shows, Sandra Babu-Boateng. We welcome back to the stage, Dr. Robert Vincent.
We want to talk about the future of Pan-Africanism. Nkrumah was in a long line of Pan-Africanists. Of course, the one that I think about most often and can relate to most is the Marcus Garvey, W.E.B. Du Bois. But Sandra, you recently interviewed Pan-Africanist and the daughter of Nkrumah. What was your takeaway from that conversation?
Thank you, Jhené, and great to be here with everyone today. So I traveled to Ghana to meet with Samia Nkrumah, who's the daughter of Kwame Nkrumah. And the reason why I made that trip, because I was curious what the daughter of one of the greatest Pan-Africanists of our time thought about her father. And that conversation was a deeply personal, historical, and also ideological account of Dr. Nkrumah's post-independence trajectory. And it was very revealing. I learned a lot. And that, you know, I consider myself an Nkrumahist. I am a Pan-Africanist. I've read a lot of books about Nkrumah. But somehow still felt like I was just discovering this man.
Oh,
right?
Listen, a daughter can tell you a lot.
Oh, yes. And that conversation did a few things. One of them, there were many takeaways, but one of the key ones, you know, reminded me of the importance of narrative. Because a lot of the things that we read about Nkrumah is filtered through Western lens. And so I had an opportunity to hear from someone who was, you know, very close to him and to see how he saw the world. And so it really impacted me. We talked about, you know, just how important narrative was to Nkrumah as well, which is why he invited W.E.B. Du Bois to Ghana later on to work on this massive project of the Encyclopedia Africana, because Nkrumah understood narrative and that he knew that that would be one of the battles, the post-independence battles that we, you know, Africa has to fight as well, is controlling the narrative. And so he invited W.E.B. Du Bois in 93. He moved to Ghana to work on that project. That was one of the missions that brought him to Ghana. And so for me, because of the work that I do in the media and storytelling and narrative, I was really interested in how Nkrumah thought about that. But perhaps the biggest takeaway from that conversation was that it reminded me of the reality that the dream, the Pan-African dream, the dream of a united Africa, what Nkrumah advocated for, is perhaps the most critical unfinished business for Africa and the global Black world today. That is the biggest unfinished business. And evolving that idea from a merely political ideology to a practical movement of continental, and I add to that, diaspora integration today, is, I think, what we need to come to the table and think about what that looks like, whether it's political, economic, or both. Where do we start to have that conversation? Because Nkrumah warned, and we're seeing it today, that until that happens, we will continue to talk about an Africa that is rising, but that never rises. Mm.
Dr. Vincent, before I add you to this conversation, I want to continue with Nkrumah's daughter. Can you tell me, like, what work is she up to these days?
Oh, she's doing a lot to really carry her father's legacy forward.
Happy to hear it.
She told me she's working on a book, and I said, hello, long overdue. I was shocked that she hasn't written a book, about her father. And I mean, she, really tried to continue in her father's legacy with his party, the CPP. She's been in government, as well. But right now where she is, she's recently launching the Nkrumah Foundation to really push forward what her father, advocated for, and really just trying to control the narrative and inspiring the new generation, right? The Gen Zs and the millennials, this new generation, inspiring a new idea of Pan-Africanism and reminding them again of this unfinished business that we need to, take the mantle and continue to push the vision forward. So she's doing a lot.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. Dr. Vincent, with this unfinished business in Africa in mind and with Nkrumah in mind, and the notions of restitution and reconciliation, they were both so symbiotic to Dr. King. And we know that he articulated three evils the civil rights movement would encounter. With respect to a united Africa and the African diaspora, how does racism, economic exploitation, which is poverty, and militarism, war, how do those three things impact the future?
Well, big question. So following Sandra's line of thinking about the unfinished business of Pan-Africanism, we always need to remember, of course, that Kwame Nkrumah was very clear that Ghana's independence was incomplete without complete continental independence. Expanding on that, this idea of continental independence meant fully economic, political, cultural sovereignty. We are still not there yet. Sandra also mentioned diaspora. And one outgrowth of Nkrumah's Pan-Africanism was the creation of what is now the African Union. And the African Union has six continental regions, geographical regions. And the seventh region is the diaspora, meaning there's a place for us in the diaspora. There's a place for us in this ongoing project of Pan-Africanism. And so when we talk about restitution, I think what we're talking about is the fulfillment of the Pan-African dream, meaning full political, economic, and cultural sovereignty of the African continent and those Africans abroad. We're not there yet, obviously, but that work needs to come together. That constitutes restitution, and without that type of restitution, there can be no reconciliation. And I think both Nkrumah and King, and I would venture to say Nkrumah's daughter, would agree with that sentiment.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to add to that, Sandra?
No, I totally agree. I tend to get very frustrated, especially African leaders, because there's been, you know, ideas over ideas. And, you know, Africa is not short on great ideas, but where, you know, we often fall short is implementation, right? And so this idea of the sixth region or seventh region, it hasn't been ratified, right? It's still an idea. And so for me, and I mean, this earlier this year, the African Union declared the year 2026 to 2036 as the decade of reparations. But what is missing is coordination, right? African Americans are fighting for reparations. It has been a long-standing, I think the bill has been in Congress for over 30 years, mm-hmm. right? And this is not even a bill for reparations, it's a bill to study the impact of slavery on America, and it's still sitting in Congress, right? The Caribbean, CARICOM, recently picked, you know, also has been fighting for reparations. And in Africa, so why aren't we doing this in a coordinated effort? We're all asking for the same thing, but in different rooms. And then when Africa shows up at the European, you know, Union Conference, the most important room where they can bring up this topic, they don't mention it.
Right.
So it's a lot of talk that's going on. Yeah. Very little action.
Very little action. Dr. Vincent?
Oh, yes. Following this thread, one benefit, one silver lining of this moment, this resurgence of white supremacy gives us clarity. If we were ever in doubt, which we should not have been, about where we are.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And Pan-Africanism gives us a framework to think beyond nations, to say that what we're going through in the U.S. is not different from what's going on in the Caribbean, mm-hmm. South America, Africa.
It's the same
fight. It's the same fight. And so Pan-Africanism is still an important ideology to think in global terms and not allow us to be picked off and isolated in our little nations or localities. And so we still need this ideology. We still need this coordination. And we have some of it. We have the diaspora returning to Africa, to Ghana, to South Africa, to other places. And of course, we have a huge African diaspora that has come since 1965, right? Mm-hmm. And the changing of immigration mm-hmm. laws. Mm-hmm. So we do have this flow, like Sandra is saying, Sandra represents this, of this new diaspora of moving back and forth, connecting our Black world mm-hmm. with allies who are with us in this struggle. And so Pan-Africanism is very much alive through this connection between the African continent and the diaspora.
Yeah.
We are one people.
Yeah. And sticking with the diaspora, and I talked with Diana Konoté earlier about this word solidarity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm curious to know both your thoughts on leveraging that solidarity.
Yeah. And I'm going to go ahead a little bit because I think it's connected to the, you know, your point here. When Nkrumah advocated for a united Africa, right? His vision was one continent, unification of the continent, one central government, one currency, one market, pretty much like the United States, right? And he really believed that that was the only way to combat the legacy of colonialism and to foster true independence and sovereignty, because you can be free on paper, but...
We know that.
Right? And he really believed that that was the only way. And when you look at Africa today, back to the point that you were making about how real this has become for us in this moment we're in, when you look at Africa today, Africa is not, it doesn't lack anything. Lack is not Africa's problem, right? Africa is the one continent that has everything that it needs to be self-sufficient. Arable land, over 70%, is still uncultivated, right? Over 1.5 billion people, the fastest growing, youngest population in the world. We have everything that we need. And the question we need to be asking is, why is Africa still poor?
Yeah. Dr. Vincent, solidarity for the diaspora?
Absolutely solidarity for the diaspora. And thinking, too, about the vastness of our diaspora. So thinking about places like Brazil. That's the country with the largest number of Black people, right? And think about Afro-Latin America broadly speaking. So Pan-Africanism is about racial solidarities and identities, but it's also the work of translation, of actually being able to connect with Black people who speak different languages, come out from different geographical regions, right? It is about Black people in Europe, it's the Black Pacific. And so the vastness of the diaspora, the Pan-African project, is beyond the Atlantic world, if you will, and crosses languages and cultures and geographies. And that's the work of Pan-Africanism, to be aware of how vast the Black world is.
Yeah.
But with notwithstanding those local distinctions of language or culture or geography or specific histories, there is that broader history of commonality, and there is that broad shared circumstance, which means that our destinies are tied together.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so that's the power of Pan-Africanism in this global framework. It's also the challenge of Pan-Africanism, but it's the opportunity to have that kind of global solidarity to move us forward.
MLK Day is a day of service. So again, as a call to action, like, what do we do?
Yeah. For me, and that's a great question, one of the things that MLK said after he returned from Ghana in his sermon, Birth of a Nation, he said, I wish, above all things, that our brother Black Americans would visit Ghana and that they would bring their technical expertise to build and develop this country that is filled with so much promise. That was many years ago, but what I would say is that is even more true today. Not just Ghana, but the entire continent needs expertise. Guess where we're going for that expertise? To China, to Russia. And as a result, we might wake up one day and learn that we don't even own the continent that is supposed to be ours. We need to go home. That's the first step. Go home, visit. There are so many opportunities that are just waiting for us, for us to come and lend whatever we can contribute, whether it's investing, you know, starting a business, lending your skills, expertise. It is needed back home. So the call to action is let's revisit what MLK said, you know, years ago, decades ago, and let's make that trip back home.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a Pan-Africanist, and I think globally, we've been talking about Pan-Africanism, and I think there is also a place practically to think locally and to think what specific skill sets or characteristics that we have. I'm an educator. I believe in impacting my students, fellow colleagues, et cetera. That's what I do. That's what I'm good at. I would not be good doing corporate stuff, right? I do the thing that I think I'm good at and that has an impact that's Pan-African-minded, but has a local impact. Others in the audience have different kinds of strengths. Leverage those strengths locally to have a greater impact, but it's connected to a global Pan-African movement and sensibility. So practically, in this day of service, we think about it. What are our strengths? What are our passions? How do we leverage that locally to have maximum impact to affect a larger global project? That's what we can do tangibly.
You two have been so wonderful. Let's give it up for our guests, please. Thank you.
Please give a warm welcome to Yoli Zama.
Get up on the seats if they want to. Nobody's making you sit down.
Sapenduga,
Sapenduga,
Tapata is a song by our beloved Miriam Makeba. We called her Mama Africa. And when her music was banned in South Africa, it was you, the diaspora, who kept her music alive and strong. Mama was a staunch Pan-Africanist whose music she played all over. And fun fact, she performed Pata Pata right here on the Apollo stages, well, next door, in 1967, shortly after releasing Pata Pata. Like Dr. King, Mama lived by the principle of Ubuntu, which is I am because we are. And so, in the spirit of we are, I'm gonna ask you to sing with me. All right? When I say, a pata pata, pata pata, you follow Vusi. Pata pata, a pata pata, 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 mama, pata pata, pata pata, pata pata, oh pata pata, mama, pata pata, oh pata pata, mama. Louder! Can we hear the group? Oh, you sound so good. Oh, pata pata mama, pata pata pata, oh pata pata mama, pata 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 mama, pata 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 mama, pata pata. Oh, you sound so good. Thank you. Pata pata, pata pata. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. We loved spending this afternoon with you. And I have to just introduce my brothers. My brother Vusi is from South Africa. And my brother Saidu Sangara is from Burkina Faso. So we are Pan-Africans. Thank you.
Yoli Zama.
This program is a co-production of WNYC, The Apollo, and March On. Thank you to all of the hosts, guests, producers, engineers, and organizing teams from all of those organizations. I'm Terrence McKnight, and thank you for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
On the next Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear the new exotic sounds of Cocktail Inn and Nouveau Luxe, plus a band that only made one album, Joe Graves and the Diggers. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
On the next Radiolab.
First, we thought we'd made some sort of mistake.
Two surprisingly simple scientific discoveries.
This is crazy. Yeah. I mean, we were just so surprised.
That make us reconsider our assumptions about progress.
We need to learn the language of the doctors of that time. We need to be a little bit less dismissive.
That's on the next Radiolab.
I learned a bit of humility this way.
Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming online at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.